They don't have metal detectors in lab school.
We have 10 seconds.
Okay. They don't have overcrowded classrooms. So I think Betsy DeVos is doing what she's supposed to do as an ultra-right-wing, unqualified person in a position she has no reason to be in, other than to advance an agenda.
We're going to continue this discussion, part two, and at WebEx in democracynow.org. Jeetu Brown of Journey for Justice Alliance in Chicago, Zixia Sankara Jabbar speaking to us from Washington, Racial Justice Now. Mark Warren, the book is Lift Us Up, and EM. Thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m., at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Filmed in Watts in 1975, Killer of Sheep follows a working man in a moment of existential crisis, trying to make ends meet at a job he finds repugnant, and trying to connect with his family and community. The Library of Congress declared Killer of Sheep a national treasure and one of the first 50 films on the National Film Registry. Again, that's Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is a couple minutes past five, and KBOO Evening News is coming up next. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years. Serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we have our weekly Wednesday Portland City Council Roundup.
There's a new report on the long-term health impact on women of sexual harassment and sexual assault.
And research shows that drug safety testing could reduce overdose deaths.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 3rd, 2018. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. It's Wednesday, meaning Portland City Council met this morning to discuss, approve, and technically hear public testimony on city business. KBOO's Sam Bowman has this report.
Portland City Council discussed two main items of business this morning. But before we get into that, yes, at exactly 11:18, this happened.
And that's going to step all over all the small players that are trying to step up and go to that bank and say, hey, I want to step in and get a loan for this commercial agreement. I can't get the money and compete. This must be Donald Trump cutting me off. Mr. Trump.
And if my phone is on silence, so absolutely. 19.
Okay.
Sure, Commissioner Fritz. Sure. Anyway, before the speaker was interrupted by the test of the National Emergency Alert System, he was testifying on proposed changes to the city's franchise agreement regulating the collection of residential solid waste. The proposed changes have been in the works since late last year under the aegis of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, or BPS. The main impetus for the changes comes from the city's stated commitment to reducing barriers for minority and women-owned businesses to get city contracts. Currently, the city is divided up into multiple franchise territories for waste collection, and private companies hold those franchises. One of the changes involves prioritizing women and minority-owned businesses when a current franchise holder seeks to sell or subcontract their franchise. Several waste hauling businesses had people in attendance this morning, all of whom were in support of the proposed changes, which also extend the length of franchises from 10 to 12 years, which allows franchisees more time to recoup their initial investments. One piece of incidental information that came out of today's testimony was pointed out by Commissioner Nick Fish, who asked this of the folks from Planning and Sustainability.
I think for anybody watching your presentation, they will be surprised to learn that we don't consider multifamily development to be residential, since it is largely residential, but by virtue of the definitions, is excluded from what we regulate, so we only regulate 20% of the market. What is the best explanation you can offer as to why multifamily is not treated as residential?
The residential system is single-family homes, duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes. So it's for development that receives a similar type of service. It's very homogenous in nature. And so we can set the rates for that service and set the service standards very easily.
Several of the waste haulers in attendance pointed out that the real difference between residential and multifamily comes down to a difference between garbage cans and dumpsters, and the trucks required to lift and dump them. Interestingly, BPS is working on a plan, with no set timetable yet, to bring multifamily developments under the same equitable franchising rules discussed today. And since the city is looking ahead to numerous bond-funded affordable housing developments, that also represents a potential windfall for waste hauling companies, as was pointed out by the executive director of the National Association of Minority Contractors Oregon chapter, Nate McCoy.
The other comment I would say is one that Nate pointed out earlier, multifamily, huge opportunity. With Metro having a bond, the Portland Housing Bureau currently having a bond, and Home Forward, who has been a partner at the table, you know, we want to carry these conversations forward because we want to expand the pie.
At the end of public testimony on that item, Orlando Simpson, owner of City of Roses Recycling, gave his take on why these changes are important, after noting that the process of getting to this point had seen its fair share of acrimony over what some saw as disruptive changes to a long-standing system.
In these particular times, I think disruption is necessary for our society, in all facets of it. And the good thing is that from that disruption and from that chaos and from that pain, we've actually been able to come to a consensus on a direction we all feel is going to be adequate, that we can go down and be proud about in the future of our solid waste and recycling system, not only for all of the constituents and stakeholders of today, primarily those that are going to be benefiting the most on the franchise agreement, but also the stakeholders and constituents of the future and the future generations. I feel like as an entrepreneur, as a business owner of color, it's my responsibility, as well as a fourth generation Portlander, to utilize the platform and foundation that my grandfather and my father have put in front of myself and my siblings and the rest of my family members to try to build something substantial and create wealth. Because as we know, wealth is the caveat to a lot of the challenges we see in society today relates to the economic disparities.
After the many people in attendance to discuss the changes to the waste hauling system had filed out of council chambers, Mayor Wheeler made a proclamation proclaiming October 8th Indigenous Peoples Day in the city of Portland. The holiday is formerly known as Columbus Day, celebrating the European who is generally considered to have opened the door to the exploitation of the Americas, the genocide of its native peoples, and their ongoing appalling treatment by colonizing governments. One of the speakers who preceded the proclamation was Jillian Joseph, executive director of the Native Wellness Institute and enrolled member of the Aani people.
In schools, you know, we learn a lot of misinformation about Columbus, and we learn that he was this great man. And what he represents to our people is the beginning of genocide. And so this day is about our people being seen and our people finding our voice and using it. And I give honor to the original people of the land that I'm on today, but I also give honor to our people that paved the way for Laura and I to be here, and to the other people to be here in this room that also found their voice and used it. and used it in a way for us to be seen. And so when we know better, we can do better. And when we look around in this room, we have descendants of colonizers here. We have miracle survivors of genocide in this room. We have the descendants of people that were slaved and are sold and enslaved. And here we are working together to make our world more just and more equitable for everyone. And that's what this day is about.
For KABU Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
Tomorrow, renowned environmental journalist Jeff Goodell will be in Portland to speak at Revolution Hall. Goodell is the author of last year's book, The Water Will Come, which looks at how rising sea levels due to climate change are already affecting regions across the world and what we can expect as the process accelerates. He is also a longtime writer for Rolling Stone, most recently of a series of articles looking at the effect of Hurricane Maria on Puerto Rico, where climate and human factors combine to produce a disaster worse than anybody was prepared for. Jeff Goodell spoke to Portland KABU on Monday, just before embarking for Portland. He discussed his book, The Situation, as he saw it in Puerto Rico, and the troubling questions posed by affluence and poverty in the face of accelerating climate change.
It's no question, there's no doubt that, you know, climate change is something that is essentially being caused by the consumption habits of the sort of rich Westerners. By that, I mean the U.S. and Europeans, and increasingly as China and India grow more prosperous, them also. And, you know, the effects are being suffered most powerfully by people in the undeveloped world, people who are living in vulnerable places, who don't have the money and the means to easily move out of high-risk areas. So this sort of the social justice aspect of this question is very powerful, and of this problem, I mean, is very powerful, and at the heart of why it's so difficult to deal with. I mean, it's at the heart of the Paris climate negotiations. It's at the heart of every international agreement. You know, or the basic question that the developing world is, you know, saying to the West is that, you know, you owe us, you need to help us. You have caused this problem and we're suffering for it. And, you know, what are you going to do about that? And that's, you know, the sort of central schism in this whole debate about climate change. And it's one that's really tough to get around.
That was environmental journalist Jeff Goodell speaking to KABU earlier this week. He will be speaking tomorrow night for an event called Resilience in the Face of Climate Change at Revolution Hall at 7 p.m.
The news out of the U.S. Senate has been mostly terrible these days, as you might have noticed if you were anywhere near a screen last week. But wait, Oregon's congressional delegation has been pulling strings behind the scenes to get a bill that would protect wide swaths of Oregon wildlands out of committee this very week. For more, KABU reporter Lucas Campbell has this report in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
A bill to protect thousands of acres and miles of river in Oregon has passed out of key U.S. Senate committee. The Oregon Wildlands Act, introduced by Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley, would designate more than 200,000 acres as wilderness and national recreation areas, add more than 250 miles of wild and scenic river protections to the state. Much of it is centered around the Rogue River, one of the original eight to gain wild and scenic protections 50 years ago. But Robin Jansen, head of Rogue River Keeper, says those protections only extend a quarter mile up the waterway's canyons, leaving much of the area vulnerable to development.
The forest and wildlands way up on the ridge tops above the river aren't protected, and those really important tributary streams that feed lots of cold, clear water into the Rogue and support our amazing salmon fishery, those tributaries aren't totally supported and protected.
The bill would add acreage to the Wild Rogue and Devil Staircase wilderness areas and wild and scenic river protections to Western Oregon rivers. It would also give recreation area protections to the Molalla and Rogue rivers. Tuesday was the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. The bill represents more than 20 years of negotiation, and backers say it would conserve lands integral to Oregon's recreation economy, which generates $16.4 billion annually in consumer spending and supports more than 170,000 jobs, according to the Outdoor Industry Association. Jansen says greater safeguards would protect jobs near the Rogue River.
it is a really important resource for us in so many different ways, but especially for the local economy. And if it wasn't protected and it was being developed or being abused by resource extraction, those jobs would be threatened.
Chris Daughters, owner of Caddy's Fly Angling Shop in Eugene, believes without protections, the region's world-class fisheries are endangered. He also wants the next generation to enjoy these lands.
We can talk about the immediate needs of the angler. We can talk about the immediate needs for the businesses and the critical outdoor industry in the state of Oregon, from fishing, hiking, boating, etc. But I mean, we've got to look down the road for our children as well.
This has been Lucas Campbell in collaboration with Oregon News Service.
A greenhouse design developed in Oregon for the marijuana industry is being put to the test in South America. Todd Delotto is a horticultural scientist and public policy consultant who specializes in cannabis. He's working with officials in Colombia to set up a pilot project to demonstrate the viability of his low-cost, environmentally friendly greenhouse design. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Delotto to find out more.
So I'm the president and horticultural scientist of CAN Research Education Consulting in Albany, Oregon. And most of my business is in designing production facilities and educating on the science of cannabis horticulture. And so my market is mainly in the on the frontier of cannabis, which has been Oregon for quite a while. But Oregon is no longer the frontier of cannabis anymore. We're on the frontier of some aspects of the cannabis industry, but frontier has moved on. And so now I'm working in other states as well as South America. I have the opportunity in Colombia to demonstrate my model of sustainable ecological hoop house design. I designed this model in Oregon for temperate climates and perfected it for this region. A lot of Oregon producers have decided to go to, you know, expensive indoor and greenhouse models. But I was presented with an opportunity in Colombia, and you know, South America, they're very much into low capital expense, low operating expense, so that they could export cheaply. And of course, you know, I'm very much into high quality, but I'm very much into both high quality and sustainable practices. So this is the perfect opportunity for me to take my model that's sustainable, enhances ecology, and demonstrate that sustainable ecological practices can also meet the low capital expense, low operating expense demands of the South American market.
Okay, without getting too technical and without revealing too many trade secrets, generally, so a hoop house, that's essentially a greenhouse kind of thing. Tell me how this would work. I mean, people have probably seen greenhouses, but you know, there's all kinds, right? Hoop, what?
Sure. A hoop house is about the simplest type of greenhouse. And so a hoop house system isn't necessarily about the structure of the greenhouse. It's more about the practices. So so in my design, it's basically a semi-passive greenhouse. And there are no environmental controls other than circulating fans and some evaporative cooling. And whereas, you know, big expensive facilities would be using lights, and they need to cool the lights with air conditioning and chillers, remove humidity. And so I designed this so that we can use just moving the air. Circulating the air does a lot to refresh the system with carbon dioxide and prevent disease. And also do some cooling as well. So, and then the other part of it is planting plants directly in the grounds, enhancing soil ecology, managing the soil not just for the plants but for the microbes, the mutualistic microbes that cooperate with the plants by breaking down the nutrients, making them available for plants, fighting off disease. So their microbes are a plant's immune system. And so instead of applying a lot of fertilizers and pesticides, the microbes do most of that work for you. And so if you get the microbes and insects to do that work for you, then you don't have to spend money on buying products and having people do it. So that's how ecological practices translate to saving money.
And you developed this with the cannabis industry in mind, but the application you're talking about, that's more than cannabis. It's just general, like, horticulture, agriculture. What kind of plants are we, any kind of plant or what?
Yeah, you know, I designed this specifically for cannabis, and the similar concept can be applied to different plants. Cannabis has a photoperiod, so that's one of the big aspects of cannabis farming, that they're photoperiod dependent. A lot of plants aren't that way, so that's one difference. So yeah, but this model can be designed for just about any other crop. The basic concept is to enhance the ecological mutualistic habitat and reduce the amount of energy you need to use, maximizing the sun, wind, and soil and environment.
That's fascinating. So you're going to be building some of these or doing a pilot project down in Colombia?
Yeah, we're doing a pilot project of 1 hectare near Bogota, and that's going to be rapidly expanding to much larger facilities. We're talking hundreds or in thousands of hectares. And if I'm successful with demonstrating that these ecological, sustainable practices can also mean low-cost production, then we will probably be seeing a lot more of this duplicated across South America, and then Southeast Asia is going to be the next low capex, low opex environment. Yeah.
Wow. Todd, how do people find out about this work that you're doing? Do you have a website? Are you publishing stuff? What do you?
Sure. People could reach me at canresearch.net is my website. And I've got a lot of educational material, and I'll be writing about this as the project develops.
Fascinating. I hope to find out more, and I wish you all the luck in the world. This sounds really incredibly cool.
Thank you. Pleasure talking with you about it.
Oh, thank you, Todd.
This is Doug McVeigh for KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the VU, which tonight features a conversation with Mike Crenshaw and Ani Haynes. At 6 o'clock, it's Kitchen Table Conversations, a spontaneous live talk radio program focused on discussing important current events and how they're impacting our community and all of us individually. And then at 7 o'clock, it's Keeping It Real, a public affairs talk radio program that strives to educate and to offer a forum for people to speak their truth while being open-minded and inclusive. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low around 48, with winds from the west at 3 to 7 miles an hour. Tomorrow it'll be mostly sunny with a high around 64 and calm winds from the south around 5 miles an hour in the afternoon. Today in history, it's German Unity Day, marking the date in 1990 when East and West Germany were officially reunited as one nation. And in 1974, Frank Robinson became the first African-American manager of a major baseball league team when he was hired by Cleveland. Our quote of the day is from Fyodor Dostoevsky, who said, "Above all, do not lie to yourself. The man who lies to himself and listens to his own lies comes to a point that he cannot distinguish the truth within him or around him, and so loses all respect for himself and for others, and having no respect, he ceases to love."
It is exactly 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In June, our immigrant-bashing president ordered an end to his own warped policy of forcibly tearing terrified migrant children from the arms of their asylum-seeking parents. Trump declared, "I didn't like the sight or the feeling of families being separated." Yeah, bad optic, as PR consultants call scenes of such thuggishness. So he and we no longer have to witness nightly TV coverage of shrieking toddlers being taken from their parents and hauled off to federal warehouses. But wait, out of sight doesn't mean the depravity has ended. Some 500 of the 2,900 children who were snatched last spring are still in government custody, scared that they'll never see their parents again and traumatized by the uncertainty of what'll happen to them. Worse, more refugee children are being incarcerated every day as they seek asylum from the horrors of rapacious gang wars and abject poverty in their Central American homelands. More than 12,000 migrant children are now out of sight and out of mind in our government's warehouses, military bases, and sprawling tent cities. And Trump is requesting money to lock up another 20,000 children. All this trauma and cost is the result of the Trumpeteers' inhumane and failed zero-tolerance policy of jailing children, even babies, in hopes of scaring other refugees from seeking asylum in our land of opportunity. They created this humanitarian crisis, and rather than ending it by rushing in hundreds of lawyers and judges to process the asylum requests, Trump and his rabidly anti-immigrant ideologues are taxing us by building more jails for refugees, while also openly violating the law that says immigrant children cannot be locked up for more than 20 days. This is Jim Hightower saying, for more about Trump's sick and sickening policy, contact Kids in Need of Defense at supportkind.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now it's time for today's Labor History in Two from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1967. That was the day that the Dust Bowl troubadour, Woody Guthrie, died. Over the course of his life, Woody Guthrie wrote almost 3,000 songs. He was one of the thousands of people who took to the road during the Great Depression, swept into wandering by the winds that churned the Dust Bowl. In an interview with NPR, fellow folk music legend Pete Seeger described Guthrie's influence, saying, quote, "We all read about music being part of people's lives, but I hadn't seen it in action until I met him. The words that came out of his mouth and the music he made all flowed together with the life that he led, and I was greatly attracted to it and kind of tagged along with him for several months. Woody showed me how to hitchhike and how to ride the freight trains, how to sing in saloons." A 2013 article in Paste magazine summarized Guthrie's legacy, writing, "No artist has ever expressed a deeper will to fight against oppression and the rights of the little guy than Woody Guthrie." Iconic author John Steinbeck wrote this vivid description of Guthrie, harsh-voiced and nasal, his guitar hanging like a tire on a rusty rim. "There is nothing sweet about Woody, and there is nothing sweet about the songs he sings. But there is something more important for those who will listen. There is the will of a people to endure and fight against oppression. I think we call this the American spirit."
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
New research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's JAMA Internal Medicine shows that sexual harassment and sexual assault have long-term implications for women's health. More than 300 women aged 40 to 60 participated in the study. 19% of the women reported a history of workplace sexual harassment, and 22% reported a history of sexual assault. Sexual harassment was found to be related to significantly greater odds of hypertension and clinically poor sleep. Sexual assault was associated with significantly greater odds of clinically elevated depressive symptoms, clinically relevant anxiety, and clinically poor sleep. The article notes that in the U.S., between two-fifths and three-fourths of all women have experienced workplace sexual harassment, and more than a third of all women have experienced sexual assault.
In the U.S., legal pharmaceutical drugs have to be tested for purity and potency. Illegal substances, on the other hand, often contain impurities, and the strength can vary widely. In recent years, some street drugs, particularly heroin, have been found to be contaminated with fentanyl, a powerful synthetic opiate. Fentanyl contamination has been identified as a driving factor in the nation's overdose crisis. Many drug policy experts and community outreach workers are advocating for safety testing of street drugs in order to save lives. Now, new research shows that testing for fentanyl in street heroin would indeed save those lives. Researchers worked with a syringe exchange in Greensboro, North Carolina, to survey people who inject drugs in order to determine whether the use of fentanyl test strips would have an effect on their drug use. They found that just over 80% of the sample used the fentanyl test strips before consuming their drugs, and almost two-thirds of the samples reported a positive result for fentanyl. Overall, 40% of the sample reported changes in their drug use behavior, most of them simply using less of the drug than they had originally planned to do.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Officials are planning to open a VA service office for Native American veterans in Oregon. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
This summer, the State Department of Veterans Affairs and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs signed a Memorandum of Understanding. Mitch Sparks is acting director of the Oregon VA and part Oglala Lakota. He says this effort has been 5 years in the making.
The Memorandum of Understanding allows the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to provide the support services and the network for them to be successful on tribal lands. I'm hoping that in this next 6 months, there could be two more tribes that sign one, and we'll do the same with them, provide the training and support services needed.
Sparks doesn't know yet when there will be a grand opening for the Warm Springs Veterans Center. About 3,900 vets in Oregon are Native American. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association was recently named the organization to carry out a law intended to boost tourism in Indian country. Tourism officials, the Department of Commerce, and the Interior Department signed a MOU naming the tourism group the national facilitator for the Native Act. Signed into law in 2016, the act is designed to improve and promote tribal tourism. Tara Sweeney is the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the Interior Department.
With this piece of legislation, it's important to understand that tribal engagement in tourism activities and using the data that we have out there to promote visitation, to promote the development of infrastructure and economic development and job creation in our communities, and having those systems in place to then attract tourism into Indian country.
Camille Ferguson is the executive director of the American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association.
This is monumental. This is a very beneficial opportunity for tribes to engage with federal agencies to be a part of their planning process for the development of tourism. This gives the tribes the to be at the table when tourism development is happening. Not after the fact.
Provisions in the Native Act include enhancing Native American tourism into federal planning and providing funding and technical assistance to tribes and Native organizations to develop and increase their tourism efforts. Tourism plays a role in providing jobs and as a revenue source for tribes across the country. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke is hosting a celebration for Virginia's 6 federally recognized tribes. The event Wednesday in Virginia will include tribal leaders, U.S. lawmakers, and state officials to celebrate the tribe's federal status, which became official earlier this year. The tribes fought for decades for federal recognition to give them direct relationship with the federal government, improve services for their people, and assist in repatriation efforts. The Crow Tribe in Montana is accused of misusing millions of dollars in grants intended to improve water systems, according to a federal audit. Nearly $5 million were intended for improvements, and an additional nearly $8 million cannot be accounted for to pay vendors, the Associated Press reports. Tribal leaders were reportedly reviewing the audit Tuesday and are expected to release a statement. An inaugural boarding school conference is being held in Carlisle, Pennsylvania this week. The National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition is hosting the event to raise awareness on the history of U.S. Indian boarding schools. Topics include trauma and healing. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Public News Service is a member-supported team that aims to cover issues that just fall outside the mainstream media. On today's episode, the New York Times alleges Donald Trump engaged in outright fraud. Also, Trump's bid to deliver postal service reforms stalls, and on its 50th anniversary, a call for cleaner air for North Cascades National Park.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Wednesday, October the 3rd, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. The New York Times alleges Donald Trump engaged in outright fraud. Also on the Wednesday rundown, Trump's bid to deliver postal service reforms stall, and on the 50th anniversary, a call for cleaner air for the North Cascades. But first, our top story, The Hill reporting President Trump engaged in tax schemes that included cases of outright fraud in which he and his siblings helped their parents dodge taxes. That from the New York Times on Tuesday. The Times investigation, which a Trump lawyer said was inaccurate, showed Trump received the equivalent today of at least $413 million from his father's real estate businesses, citing a vast trove of confidential tax returns and financial records. The Times reported that much of the fortune came to Trump because he helped his parents evade taxes, setting up fake corporations with his siblings to disguise millions of dollars in gifts from their parents. The Hill notes that during his presidential campaign, Trump promoted himself as a self-made real estate mogul who started out with only a very small loan from his father, Fred Trump. Meantime, Trump's announced intentions to reform the U.S. Postal Service in April landed with a thud, and now, 6 months later, a White House-appointed committee report on the topic has been shelved.
The Postal Service enjoys wide popularity with a 90% favorable rating, and the reform package delivered to the president on August 10th has not been released. Former New York Congressman John McHugh is a spokesman for the Package Coalition, a group that formed to highlight the importance of the Postal Service's package delivery capabilities.
If you look at really the thousands upon thousands of small businesses that have sprung up in virtually every part of this country, the Postal Service in that construct becomes an awfully important part of the current economic fabric of this country.
The Trump administration has said the Postal Service needs to operate more efficiently after reporting a net loss of $2.7 billion in fiscal 2017. I'm Roz Brown.
Last month, Missouri Democrat Senator Claire McCaskill introduced a bipartisan resolution to ensure that the Postal Service remains an independent establishment of the federal government and not subject to privatization. Civil rights groups, including the ACLU and Lambda Legal, are setting their sights on a ban on local protections for LGBTQ individuals in the state of North Carolina that was written into a controversial House bill. More from Stephanie Carson.
Late Monday, a federal court ruled that the law intended to replace the bathroom bill does not bar transgender people from using public facilities. Chris Brook with the ACLU of North Carolina says the decision clears the way for the next step in regaining local protections for transgender people.
HB 142 took away the ability of cities and counties to offer anti-discrimination protections for anyone, whether it be on veteran status, whether it be against age discrimination, or the ability of cities and counties to offer protections for the LGBT community.
Plaintiffs in the case argued that HB 142's vagueness effectively barred transgender people from using restrooms in government buildings. Supporters of HB 142 say it was a measured compromise when HB 2 was taken off the books after public outcry and protest from private industry.
The ruling was applauded by such national groups as the Human Rights Campaign. In addition to the plaintiffs, no word yet if the state plans to appeal. And new money will soon be flowing into Kentucky to help close the achievement gap. Mary Sherman reports state leaders Tuesday announced that Kentucky is one of six states to win a $24.5 million Gear Up grant from the U.S. Department of Education.
Executive Vice President of the Kentucky Council on Post-Secondary Education, Aaron Thompson, explains the money will be used to increase the number of low-income students graduating from high school and enrolling in college or workforce training programs. And he believes it's the right program at the right time for Kentucky.
This grant is there to serve our underserved populations. And as you've seen with the results of the testing in Kentucky, many of these students need the kind of assistance that we're talking about that this grant can bring.
The Kentucky Department of Education's annual student assessment released last week identified 481 schools as needing to close the achievement gap for students who have been underserved. Starting next year, the Gear Up grant will help at least 10,000 students in middle and high school in at least 10 school districts.
And finally, Eric Tegetoff tells us North Cascades National Park turns 50 this week.
One group wants Washington State to give the park a gift with stronger air pollution controls on a nearby oil refinery.
The Washington State Department of Ecology has approved facility updates to BP's Cherry Point Refinery north of Bellingham, allowing it to increase production by nearly 9,000 barrels a day, up from its current volume of about 236,000 barrels a day. Rob Smith with the National Parks Conservation Association says in order to expand, the state should also require the oil company to install better pollution protections, and it has the technology.
BP should do what they've done at their other refineries around the country, which is install fully modern pollution control equipment, and Ecology is simply not asking them to do that. We believe they should, and we hope the governor will encourage Ecology to do that.
The National Park Service says the Cherry Point expansion would increase the average number of impaired air quality days at North Cascades from 38 to 54 days a year.
The National Park Conservation Association has launched a petition calling on Governor Jay Inslee to direct the Department of Ecology to revise the Cherry Point expansion permit to require stronger anti-pollution measures. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Speaking at an energy forum in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin made harsh remarks about a former double agent who was poisoned in England earlier this year. The British government says that Sergei Skripal was poisoned with a Russian-made nerve agent called Novichok in March while living in the English city of Salisbury. Skripal and his daughter Yulia were found passed out on a park bench, but both survived. In July, British intelligence believes the same substance was responsible for the poisoning of a British couple in a town near Salisbury. The woman, Dawn Sturgis, later died. The two incidents led to a diplomatic crisis between Russia and the United Kingdom, with the UK claiming that the two Russian visitors to Salisbury during the same time as the Skripal poisoning were agents of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, the GRU. Today, Putin dismissed the crisis as an argument between intelligence services, saying the link to the Russian travelers was bogus. He also called Skripal, who was once imprisoned in Russia for spying, a, quote, scumbag and a traitor. Putin has long been under suspicion due to murders and suspicious deaths of opposition politicians and journalists, charges he has always managed to avoid, despite occasionally expressing public approval for the incidents.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 3rd, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman and Lucas Campbell. Our producer is Doug McVeigh, and our engineer is David Kesters. The Evening News and Public Affairs directors are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Native Voices from the Edge with Carrie and Amory. At 9, Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9 on Fight the Empire, Pear talks about life, death, and insanity on planet Earth. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, we'll hear from two of the contributors to Writing for Animals, new perspectives for writers and instructors to educate and inspire. And at 11, Black Book Talk asks guests and listeners what they're reading. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. We'll be right back.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo, weekly news segment brought to you by myself, Mike Crenshaw, or Delphine Crescenzo, station co-manager here at KBOO, news from in and around the KBOO community. And tonight I have a very special guest many of you are familiar with, Ani Haynes. Ani, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Right on. We're here to talk about the Grassroots Radio Conference that KBOO is actually hosting this year, which is a very big deal. First of all, Ani, what is the Grassroots Radio Conference?
That's a good question. Let's start there. The Grassroots Radio Conference came together in the late 90s as a response to it was sort of a national directive put out by the Corporation for Public Broadcasters, which is the sort of governmental support for independent community broadcast stations. The mandate was for stations to become more independently financially viable. And their plan was to make stations that are independent community-based stations like KBOO into what was going to amount to be NPR clones. They wanted stations to cut out radical programming and fringy programming that was directed to the smaller communities that may be listening, and to replace that with programs that would appeal to a wider audience. And a lot of us thought wider audience, you know. And they called this the Healthy Stations Initiative. Uh-huh. And those of us that were involved at the time that saw the destructive nature of this called it the Wealthy Stations Initiative. Mm. And so this was being put out, like I said, from the CPB in the late 90s. And it was picked up pretty heavily by Pacifica at that time and modeled by them. So that